This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Now we turn our attention to another very big story developing this week in Iraq. Wednesday, as we mentioned, is the day Saddam Hussein is scheduled to begin his trial, at least his first trial. Joining us now is Michael Scharf, director of the Frederick K. Cox International Law Center at Case Western Reserve University. He was one of five international law experts selected by the Department of Justice to help train judges for the Iraqi Special Tribunal. And he joins us now from the studios of member station WCPN in Cleveland. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil. It's good to be on with you.
Now, first of all, tell us a little bit about the process of selecting and training these judges. The Iraqi justice system was presumably left in shambles by the collapse of the Saddam Hussein government.
You know, there's a lot of surprises about Iraq, and one of them was that even under Saddam's repressive regime, there were 20,000 members of the Iraqi Bar Association and about 1,000 judges who were under the radar of Saddam Hussein, going to work every day and just doing their thing of prosecuting cases involving murders and rapes and theft and arson and things that had nothing to do with Saddam Hussein's politics. And then instead of corrupting that court system, he created a separate court system, a security court system, in order to persecute his political opponents. So when they went around trying to pick judges for this Iraqi Special Tribunal, they had a large pool of 1,000 people to choose from. About 100 of them they excluded because they were associated with the special terrorist security courts. Then another couple of hundred were excluded because they were members of the Ba'ath Party. And then another 200 were excluded because somewhere in their background there was something that would have caused bias against Saddam Hussein. Maybe one of their family members had been attacked or subject to abuse. And that left about 500 really very qualified judges that they could choose from. They interviewed all of them, and this is the Iraqi Bar Association and the Iraqi government, not the United States, who chose them. And they ended up with a group of people, 50 in all, who are very talented and very committed to a fair trial in this case.
And what about the procedures that will be used? This is not what would look familiar to somebody who is familiar with American courts.
No, the Iraqi court system was based on the civil law model, which they use in France and in Egypt. And that's a model where the judge plays a much greater role than the prosecutor and the defense counsel in the actual trial proceedings. It'll be the judge, for example, who will be asking the questions of the witnesses, questions that will be submitted to the judge by the prosecutor and defense counsel. But in some ways, this court looks like the international tribunals at The Hague and Rwanda. It borrowed their rules of procedure for all of the rights of the defense, and it borrowed their definitions of all the crimes, like genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. And so it's a hybrid court that has a lot of attributes of the international tribunals.
And it's obviously important not just that the trial be fair, but be seen to be fair. I assume the Iraqi judges you've talked to are quite cognizant of this.
Yeah, they said a lot of interesting things. I want to share a couple of them with you. One is, during the training sessions, they were very interested in what their legacy would be. And they asked, for example, if I thought in 20 years, if I were training judges from another international tribunal somewhere else in the world, whether we'd be talking about the precedents that were set by the Iraqi Special Tribunal. And I thought that's a really good sign, because they're thinking about their legacy, not just in terms of trying to get a conviction. They also said that they were aware that there were some acquittals at Nuremberg and in the Yugoslavia, and they wanted to know how the world looked at those. And I explained that that was a sign the world thought that these tribunals were fair. And they said, well, we'll probably have some acquittals too. We're going to really bend over backwards to force the prosecution to fully prove his case. So I think that in the end, there may be some lower level people that are acquitted. Saddam Hussein may in fact be found not guilty of some of the charges. These judges are very much interested in being seen as fair, as you say.
And there will be, however, a sequence of trials of Saddam Hussein. Do we know how many?
Well, there could be as many as a dozen. There are some very big situations that need to be tried. The Anfal campaign, obviously, the attacks against the Southern Marsh Arabs, the invasion of Iran and Kuwait, and other incidents. And so this very small, narrowly tailored first trial should not in any way be seen as the end of the day here. It's just the beginning. And to correct some of the misperceptions that are out there in the public, they will not implement the death penalty, even if he is found guilty and given the death penalty at the end of the first trial, because the judges know that part of their job is creating a historic record of abuses that go over a 23-year period of time, and their statute says that they cannot have trials in absentia. They cannot try him without him being alive and present in the courtroom. So they will not execute him after this first mini-trial. He will stand trial for these other charges.
And the first trial will revolve around events in the town of Dujal in 1982. Why start there?
Well, in some ways, this was not the preference of either the United States government or the Iraqi government. They wanted to begin with a bang instead of a peep. But what they're getting is a trial that the prosecutors wanted to start with. And from a prosecutor's point of view, it's really a brilliant strategy. The trial is very manageable. It'll be nice and short. It won't be like the four-year mega trial that's going on in The Hague for Slobodan Milosevic. They have incredibly strong evidence, and they had finished this case investigation earlier than the others. Their evidence has witnesses who were actually there, could tell the story of what happened. Some of the subordinates who were given orders to do these terrible things will be testifying. They found all sorts of documents related to this trial, and there's forensics evidence and even videotape. So this is a really good case from a prosecutor's point of view. There's also fewer defenses available for Saddam Hussein, and the attacks that are likely to come on the legitimacy of the tribunal will be the focus of the first trial, and those will then be out of the way so that in the more important trials to come, they can focus on the evidence.
If you have questions about Iraq's justice system, about the trials of Saddam Hussein, give us a call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And Michael Scharf mentioned documents, the whispered tales of torture, assassination, and genocide that were unleashed into the Iraqi collective consciousness over the rule of Saddam Hussein turn out to have been well documented. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Hassan Nemne, Executive Director of the Iraq Memory Foundation, which collects these documents of atrocities under Saddam Hussein's rule using captured Ba'ath Party documents, oral histories from everyday Iraqis and other sources. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
It's obviously important for Iraqis to delve back into their past. One of the things that has happened in that country since the fall of Saddam Hussein is that it doesn't seem to have yet been a recognition of what had gone on in the past.
Well, to a large extent, because what has gone on in the past seems to be continuing in different shapes, in different forms, but nonetheless it is still there. What used to be a regime seems to have metamorphosed now into an insurgency, and the same tactics of terrorizing, of brutalizing, of instilling fear as a way of control seems to be in place.
So there's been no opportunity for reflection on what had gone on over the past 20, 25 years.
Absolutely. Actually, judging from other experiences internationally, there is a time lag, a delay between the traumatic experience that a society lives and the time when it is ready really to face it up front. And in the case of Iraq, counting that time has not started because the trauma is not over yet.
Mm-hmm. There are some countries where it has been decided that it is better to ignore the past, to try to prosecute everybody who had anything involved in atrocities of the past would just go too deeply into society. Let's try to forget it and move on. There are other examples, South Africa, where the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and of course trials as well, went ahead and tried to examine the past.
Yes, and actually to a large extent, I mean, what our task is simply to provide the tools for Iraqi society to decide on its own down the line which of where between these two extremes it would like to see its course of action happen. However, what we have in the case of the Saddam trial is an instance in which in one way or another, Iraqi society is forced with confronting that past, and albeit selectively. Indeed, there are going to be a number of trials, and indeed we can already anticipate the type of defenses, the lines of defense that Saddam is going to take. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I mean, Iraqi society is today forced with, meaning having to face this reality.
Mm-hmm. Why, Michael Scharf said earlier that there is exceptionally good evidence in terms of the incident in Dujal in 1982. Do you agree?
That seems to be the case. However, I mean, the lines of defense that I was mentioning are going to be as follows. I mean, the first line of defense is to question the legitimacy of the court,
yes.
to say that the court has cannot try me as Saddam because it does not have legitimacy. Second line of defense is, and even if it had legitimacy, the facts that it has are not accurate. Actually, they're falsified, they're false, and therefore it does not hold. And even the third line would be, even if those facts are true, one way or another, I did not know about them. And even if I knew about them, this would be line four, it is a legitimate, justified action. And line five would be, even if it is not justified, these actions continue up until today. What we're seeing here, the collective punishment, the abuse of power, is still taking place. And therefore, this is selective prosecution, if you'd like. So nonetheless, I mean, in this case, in the case of Dujail, I think at least number two and three of the lines of defense, meaning the fact that denying the facts of what has happened and then denying that through responsibility of command, Saddam had knowledge cannot hold.
Let's get some callers involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255. And we'll begin with Sid. Sid's calling us from Asheville, North Carolina.
Thank you for this opportunity. I have a question regarding this trial, upcoming trial. One is, how many counsels does Saddam have under his representation? And will he be able to go ahead and disqualify them or fire them during the middle of the trial and acquire a new counsel just as a prolonged tactic of stalling?
Michael Scharf?
Well, Saddam Hussein's, Saddam Hussein's lead counsel is al-Dalami, who we've seen a lot in the news in the last few days. He's being assisted by perhaps 50 other really high-power superstar lawyers from all over the world, including Ramsey Clark, the former Attorney General of the United States. Now, it is possible for Saddam Hussein to replace his lawyers, but if he does it as a stalling technique, the tribunal is likely to rule much as the Rwanda tribunal has and say that that is not acceptable. It's not a good grounds for replacing a lawyer halfway through the trial.
Talk to us for a second. You mentioned this a little bit earlier, but about the role of lawyers in this court. It, again, will not be the advocate system that we see in American courtrooms.
No, the lawyers will be asking their questions to the judge, and rather than object to a question that's being asked after the fact, the judges will just make determinations of relevancy and prejudice after they hear each question before they decide to ask the witness to respond. One of the things that's interesting about these lawyers, however, is that they're not necessarily going to be just trying their case in the courtroom. They're probably going to be trying their case in the court of public opinion, outside in the media and on the courtroom steps. And there is some precedent for this. The same Ramsey Clark who's representing Saddam Hussein represented Slobodan Milosevic at The Hague. And on the first day of his trial, he had a brief, which I call the brief to discredit the court. And rather than filing that brief in court, he never did. Instead, he gave it to the press. It was widely reported, and it was used to try to attack the legitimacy of the court and also the legitimacy of the U.S. actions in Yugoslavia. I believe that Ramsey Clark is likely to take that page out of his playbook and do the exact same thing on Wednesday.
And if that's true, then what can we do, or what can they go ahead and project to stop that or to hinder that?
Well, there's not much they can do. The judges are going to have full control of what happens inside the courtroom, but it's for the media's discretion how they deal with things that the lawyers do outside the court, just like it is in the United States. And
well,
I do predict this is going to be a messy trial. It's going to have a circus atmosphere. It's going to be a little bit like the international version of the O.J. Simpson case.
Sid, you were trying to get in there. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Will there be a jury?
No, in this case, there are five judges who will make their decision by majority vote, and then it's appealable to a nine-judge appeals chamber.
Sid, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
We're talking about the trials of Saddam Hussein, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Hassan Nemneh, let me ask you about the effect on the Iraqi people. Again, this is a unique moment in Middle East politics where a former leader is going to be tried by his own people. The trials are going to be broadcast. There's going to be intense interest, don't you think?
Absolutely. And the issue of perception, the issue both at the Iraqi level and also at the wider Arab level, is of extreme importance. Down the line, what the tribunal has chosen to do is to focus on individual cases, because these cases are This is what courts do. I mean, they prosecute events. They do not prosecute systems. However, in the court of public opinion, there is a need. There is an absolute need on the part of critics of Saddam, civil society organizations, to push the issue beyond the events and beyond the incidents, beyond the particular instances of criminality that Saddam and his regime has engaged in, into demonstration of the systemic nature of the persecution, of the oppression, and of the complicity that has that the Saddam regime involved the whole of Iraqi society in. Ultimately, it's this success, meaning in the second court, the success of contextualizing the incidents that are being dealt with in the court, which will prove of a lasting value with regard to Iraqi society.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Dylan. Dylan calling us from Lansdale, Pennsylvania.
Hi, yes. I was wanting to know if there are going to be any other trials prior to 1982 against Saddam.
You mean incidents that date back further than 1982?
Yes.
Michael Scharf?
No, I think 1982 is going to be the beginning point, and then everything goes off from there. You have the Anfal campaign in the late 1980s. You've got the invasions of Iran and then later Kuwait. You've got the attacks against the southern Marsh Arabs in the 1990s. So I think 82 will be the beginning point, actually.
I have one small question, too. Will any of this be broadcasted to the American people, like on, say, In Demand or something like that?
Well, the answer to the...
Charlie,
go ahead. Neil, you want me to take a stab at that?
Why don't you take a stab at that, yes.
Yeah. The judges have to decide on the opening day of trial whether they're going to be broadcasting, but the rumor has it that they are going to be broadcasting with like a 20-minute delay for security reasons and that they won't be showing the faces of the judges for their own safety. The broadcast, however, is not going to be in English. It's in Arabic, which is the official language of this tribunal, and it'll probably be up to the media to supply interpretation.
So, Dylan, you may want to call Court TV, see if they're interested.
Well, that's what I was wondering. So it's still up in the air whether it's going to be broadcasted in the United States or not. There's still no decision?
Not as far as I know.
Okay,
Dylan.
Thank you. Get back to work.
Thanks very much for the phone call. We'd like to thank you, Hassan Namneh, for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hassan Namneh is the director of the Iraq Memory Foundation, who was kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. We're going to continue talking about the trials of Saddam Hussein, including we'll be talking with one of the former members of his defense team when we come back from a short break. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us questions by email, and the address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're continuing our preview of the trial of Saddam Hussein, which is scheduled to begin in Baghdad on Wednesday. It's expected that there will be a day or two of motions to the special court there, and that they will then adjourn to give attorneys more time to prepare a defense of Saddam Hussein. Our guest is Michael Scharf. He's law professor and director of the Frederick K. Cox International Law Center at Case Western Reserve University and head of the Iraqi Special Tribunal's Academic Consortium. And he helped train some of the Iraqi judges who were taking part in the trial. Joining us now is Curtis Dobler, a human rights lawyer and one of the only American on the team of 23 defense lawyers that was selected by Saddam Hussein's family, which is now his former representation team. Curtis Dobler, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
Who will actually represent Saddam when the trial gets underway?
Well, first, let me correct you, if I may, that right now the president does not have any lawyers of his own choosing. That is a fallacy that has been perpetuated by a number of individuals, including Professor Scharf, in different forms. But the president has asked to see lawyers to be able to choose his own lawyer, and he has been denied that. I can tell you he has been denied that even though the Iraqi government has agreed to these meetings, but the U.S. authorities have said he may not meet lawyers that they do not want him to meet. And the court has chosen one lawyer that he may meet, that is Khalil al-Dulaimi. And Mr. Dulaimi has tried to maintain contact with them as best as he can. But, for example, today, just a few days before the hearing, he was not even able to travel out of his house in Ramadi because of military operations being carried out there. This is a house where he has his office, which has been ransacked twice by U.S. military, and where they have taken papers from him that are relevant to this trial. Under these circumstances, I think that to even speak of a trial is a misnomer.
So you don't think that there's any hope that Saddam Hussein could get a fair trial?
It's not only me that doesn't think that there is any hope that he can get a fair trial, but much more experienced speakers, such as the current head of the tribunal in The Hague, the High Commissioner of Human Rights for the United Nations. Even your own guest there today, Mr. Michael Scharf, has pointed out that this tribunal is a puppet of the United States government. I would suggest when he said that in 2003, it is even more correct today, because at that time there had not been time to determine whether or not human rights would be respected before this tribunal, whether or not due process and the right to fair trial would be respected. Now we know those rights cannot be respected and have not been respected.
Michael Scharf?
Curtis Stobler and I had a very interesting hour-long nationally televised debate on C-SPAN a couple of months ago, which you can read the transcript of on the Saddam Hussein blog that we've created at Case Western Reserve Law School. A lot of issues came up. One thing I do want to point out is in 2003, I said that I was worried that the tribunal would be perceived as a puppet court. And since that time, I've learned so much information about the tribunal that I am much more satisfied that it is bending over backwards to try to make this as fair a system as possible. To define fairness, there are three elements. First of all, you have to have fair procedures. And on paper, these procedures are the best papers available, the best procedures. They are the same ones that are used in the Yugoslavia tribunal and the Rwanda tribunal. And then you have to have really good lawyers. And I think the people that Saddam Hussein has on his side, including Dulaimi, are just superb lawyers, and they're going to be bringing up every possible motion for the tribunal to consider. And then you have to have fair judges. And having worked for a year with these judges, I know that these judges are, first of all, well-vetted. They have no inherent biases against Saddam Hussein. They're ready to acquit if the prosecution doesn't prove its case, and they're very concerned about their legacy and the appearance of fairness. So all the ingredients are there.
Is Mr. Dobler right that these are not lawyers of Saddam Hussein's choosing?
Well, I think that there's a lot of confusion about which lawyers were chosen and which ones weren't. I think that his daughter and his wife chose over 100 lawyers at one point, and then with his daughter's permission, Dulaimi ended up firing most of them and then rehiring the top 50 or so. But Dulaimi has been working with Saddam Hussein. Saddam seems to be cooperating and happy with his head counsel, and there are many other lawyers behind the scenes that are just really superstar lawyers that are working for him. Now, if he didn't want them, he could have them fired, which is what he did a couple of weeks ago. The ones that are still on the team are obviously those of his choice.
Mr. Dobler, what lines of argument are we likely to hear from those attorneys and from Saddam Hussein in the in the first trial that we know about it, about this revenge for this assassination attempt in Dujail?
As I'm sure you understand, anybody concerned with this matter cannot comment on the defenses that might be raised. What I can respond to, though, are the comments by Michael Scharf, which I think are distinctly misleading. He suggests that this is a competent tribunal. I'm sure he is aware of the articles in the fourth Geneva Convention that prohibit any occupying power from reordering the legal order of a country. And the United States very clearly, in fact, there's no argument that the court was created when the United States was an occupying power, clearly. We suggest they are still an occupying power today, but certainly they were when the court was created. Moreover, he says that it is independent. If you want to visit the president, even if you have the authorization of the Iraqi authorities, you have to have the authorization of the United States military. If you want to give documents to the court, you are stopped sometimes, as happened today, by the United States military. So I would suggest that this court is not only under the control of other type of executive bodies, but it is certainly under the control of the occupying power. And lastly, he points out that the judges are impartial. I'm glad that Michael can understand that after training them for maybe 2 weeks. Most lawyers that study international law, it takes them years to be able to understand the law, and it takes most lawyers years to be able to understand whether or not a judge is impartial by looking at their record. None of these judges have records. In fact, the only thing that we were able to find out about any of these judges is that some of them have lived recently in Iran, one of the countries that claims to be an enemy of the president.
Well, I'm Michael Scharf. I'm sure we could debate a lot of these points. I wanted to bring some listeners into the conversation if I could. Let's talk with John. John's calling us from King of Prussia in Pennsylvania.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was kind of wondering how the judges of Iraq and U.S. is going to handle the questions about the Iran-Iraq war when we backed Saddam and also gave him weapons of mass destruction, and also dealing with the Oliver North trial.
Mr. Dobler, is that going to be a question? Again, I'm not trying to get you to give away defense tactics here.
Well, of course, we have to. Any defense lawyer will respond, not we, but the defense lawyers, if the president is allowed to have access to defense lawyers. And I must say, Michael is correct in pointing out that there are many lawyers who have said that they are willing to represent the president. There are several lawyers who are former ministers who have said they are willing to represent the president. Till now, they have been denied that opportunity. They do not represent the president. I do not represent the president. I think that's something to be very clear about. The president does not have any lawyer of his own choosing and only has a court-appointed lawyer, Khalil al-Dulaimi. As to what the charges will be, that's speculation very much right now. In fact, there has not yet been a presentation of a formal document that lists the charges.
Let me ask you, Michael Scharf, then. There have certainly been fairly well-documented allegations that the United States supported Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War and provided him with, among other things, satellite imagery that he may have used to perpetrate attacks and that sort of thing. There are things that he could use to maybe embarrass the United States.
There is no question that this trial and the trials that come after are going to raise embarrassing issues for the Bush administration and for previous administrations. Even this very small trial of Dujail is going to allow the defense the opportunity to say what Saddam Hussein did to this small town where he was responding to an assassination attempt in a place that there were insurgents and terrorists is no different than what General William Casey is doing in other towns throughout Iraq this week, where they're going in and trying to root out terrorists. They're killing people. Some innocent civilians are collateral damage casualties, and they're taking a lot of people into custody. And he's going to say, what's the difference? And I do think that this trial is going to be extremely interesting in raising some novel issues in international law about what a country can do in defense against terrorist incidents and where the line must be drawn.
Mr. Dobler, can you tell us what you think the appropriate venue for this trial ought to be?
I have said many times before in public that the appropriate venue for the trial of any individual is a venue that is competent, independent, and impartial. The criteria for a tribunal that is able to try anybody for international crimes, and it should be no doubt about it, the crimes that are allowed to be before the special court now, as its name has been changed from the special tribunal, but certainly an extraordinary court, the crimes that may come before this tribunal are international crimes. There is a reference to Iraqi law, but it is a very superficial reference to it, and the crimes are international crimes, crimes that are very complex. Crimes that require judges, not only the most senior judges in a country, but the most senior judges in the international community. In the Hague tribunals and in the International Criminal Court, we didn't go out and just select the run-of-the-mill judges. Judges like the investigative judge in this case, who was, before becoming a judge, the translator to the American administrator of the Coalition Provisional Authority. Instead, in those other cases, in the Hague Tribunal and in the International Criminal Court, the international community went out and looked for the judges of the highest degree of qualification anywhere in the world. And those are the people who they said are going to be the ones that can decide matters of this very important nature. Instead, in this case, it seems like we've gone out and done things that are explicitly in violation of the basic rules of due process. and have made this court, through doing that, a illegitimate body to try such cases.
Michael Scharf, why is this trial going to be held under extremely tight security and effectively behind barricades in the Green Zone in Baghdad and not in The Hague?
And as Curtis Stobler pointed out, I was an initial advocate for having an international trial. The problem was that some of the countries that have a veto on the Security Council, namely France and Russia, made it known that they would not support a Security Council-created tribunal for Saddam Hussein. So the other option that was explored was the Permanent International Criminal Court, also in The Hague, but that court statute says that it cannot prosecute any crime that occurred before July 2002. That left a domestic prosecution as the only alternative. And yet, what they tried to do is internationalize the tribunal. They made it independent from the rest of the Iraqi court system and from the Iraqi government. They funded it fully. They gave these judges the most extensive training that any judges have ever had for an international war crimes trial. And I must say, I've also been engaged in training the judges for the Hague Tribunal and the Rwanda Tribunal. And the judges for the Iraqi Tribunal are ready. They're every bit as ready as the other judges. I also have to say this, even these distinguished judges, the best ones in the world that are picked for international tribunals, they end up making mistakes, and then I end up having to write long law review articles criticizing it. And I'm sure that this trial also will be full of errors and missteps. But at the end of the day, the question is, was there a miscarriage of justice? And I don't think there will be.
John, thanks very much for the call. We're talking about the trials of Saddam Hussein. Our guests are Michael Scharf, a law professor and director of the Frederick K. Cox International Law Center at Case Western Reserve University, and Curtis Stobler, international human rights lawyer. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Greg. Greg's calling us from San Antonio, Texas.
Hi.
Hi.
My question regards, I know that the court is only going to be focusing on his actions from 82 to the present, but how much of his, I guess, his experiences as president in Iraq in the past are going to be included in maybe representing his character as a, you know, as a president or, you know, a ruling dictator in that country?
What do you mean, Greg?
Well, in effect, you know, he, I guess he, back in 77, he was awarded a an award by the United Nations for his accomplishments in supporting education. He also appointed...
So you're talking about the good things he may have done for his country?
Yes, correct.
Okay. Curtis Stobler?
Well, one thing that is true, if you were to look at the early record of the president of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, and the record, for example, of the current president of the United States, George W. Bush, you would find that there is a striking difference between them, a difference that indicates that the president of Iraq did much more to improve the economic and security of his country than the United States president has done during his 5 years in office.
I think the question is whether he's going to be able to bring this kind of thing up at trial.
That will depend very much on the court. Certainly there is going to be an opportunity at trial to determine somebody's character, but what I am trying to point out is that the issue of character is an important issue insofar as the character of the person who we are trying here, in fact, even the more recent character of the person who is on trial, there is very little distinction between that character and the character of individuals who are currently heads of state. There is almost unanimous consensus in the international community, for example, that the President of the United States, George W. Bush, is responsible for crimes of aggression because of the illegal invasion of Iraq. That is not being tried for this tribunal, nor could it be. And that alone questions the legitimacy of selective justice.
Michael Scharf, let me ask you that question of character. Throughout these trials, as they're presented to the Iraqi people and broadcast in Arabic, the character of this man is likely to emerge.
As it does in all international trials, I think we feel we know Slobodan Milosevic very well after his 4 years on the stand. But what these trials are going to do is constitute snapshots of evil. They're going to prove with specificity certain things that Saddam Hussein did, which are just heinous atrocities. And those who think he's just a terrific guy, and maybe some of his supporters who are insurgents out there, are going to have to think twice when they see videotapes of some of these massacres and atrocities. Much like in Serbia just a couple of months ago, the standing of Slobodan Milosevic plummeted when video was shown at his trial about what really happened at the Srebrenica massacre.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have. We thank you both for your time today. Curtis Dobler is an international human rights lawyer who served as a member of Saddam Hussein's legal team. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Michael Scharf is director of the Frederick K. Cox International Law Center at Case Western Reserve University and was one of five international law experts selected by the Justice Department to help train judges for the Iraqi Special Tribunal. And he joined us from the studios of member station WCPN in Cleveland. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.